The Spinoff Podcast Network. Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
The Fold is brought to you by oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Nau mai, hoki mai ki a The Fold, e mihi nei, ko Duncan Grieve tōku ngoa. My guest today is Madison Reedy, who I've known for quite a few years now, even though she's only 28, and she's one of the most interesting and impressive young journalists in New Zealand for reasons I'll get into. And I'm aware that we're recording and releasing this episode less than a week after we got the devastating news about News Hub. And you know, Madison and I spoke a little bit off air about that. She's ex-News Hub herself, got her start there, learned a lot over there. But this episode is actually about hope, you know, not to get too sort of intense with it, but this moment that we're going through in media is a pretty devastating one. There's all kinds of things going on right now which aren't going to come back, and I don't want to kind of underplay that. But there is also opportunity, and people are doing things right now which absolutely give light to this media needs to innovate thing. It's happening. But they also show that there is opportunity out there if you kind of have a real vision and an audience centricity and just go hard and make something. And so Madison Reedy, started at RNZ and then moved to News Hub, then ultimately went and worked at Jardines, which is a big New Zealand investment bank, sort of competes with the likes of Goldman Sachs in this area. So was very young and very much at a pretty high level within the sort of markets food chain. And she speaks about that sort of early career and then jumping into a sort of a client-side situation, and also just how she ended up in markets and business in the first place, which is not, it's a relatively esoteric form of journalism, especially for someone who was then still as young. But she also talks about why it didn't work necessarily at Jardine in terms of what they intended to do. And some of that's just about real constraints that are on you when you're making content for an investment bank as opposed to a media outlet. And she started to work on this idea for a YouTube-centric show called Markets with Madison, pitched the idea to the Herald, they liked it, and they brought her on. And as we release this, it's the 100th episode of Markets with Madison, which is a twice-weekly show that runs on the New Zealand Herald, but also on YouTube and basically all social platforms. That it's not a kind of a market news show so much as it is a place where you can go deep into a particular topic within the sort of finance and markets area. The reason I reached out to Madison was recently she interviewed Adrian Orr, the governor of the Reserve Bank, who's by any standards a remarkable and formidable intellect, just an amazing person, but also really grouchy, can often come off as very dismissive of being questioned at all, and certainly being questioned about particular aspects of his job or the way the Reserve Bank has kind of run its decision making. And Madison basically went up to the Reserve Bank, asked some pointed questions of Adrian about the money printing and the kind of just general volume of stimulus that went into the economy through COVID, and that is, part of the reason we have this kind of sticky, pernicious inflation at the moment. And these were very reasonable questions, and he responded in a really in a particularly kind of aggressive and dismissive way, which I don't, think the situation warranted. I don't think he particularly answered the questions very well. But she did that. She released it, got an amazing response. We'll play down a little bit of it during the show. But it's just, I was just really admired her for going to do that. This is a very powerful and intense individual, and she just got a pretty electrifying interview out of it. But, that's just part of this kind of 100-episode run that she's had, just building out a brand on across multiple platforms, and really, using almost a tech-centric, iterative process of constant improvement, and has created a big brand and international audience for what she's done by having a real vision for the product. And as we move from, owned audiences in a sort of linear print, sort of radio type environment, to one where they're sort of fought for and won every day in these different audience behavioral eras, you have to look at shows like Markets with Madison as kind of little miniature case studies. And I have to give NZME some credit, because there is actually quite a few examples in their stable of where they built something that's quite specific. The most obvious one being the Alternative Commentary Collective, and just let it be to an extent. It doesn't necessarily fit within their paradigm, but it's working. And that is something that organization has figured out, that I think all of us in media could stand to do. Anyway, it's just Madison's a really, really amazing talent, and very articulate and incisive about what it is she's doing. So it's been great to have her on the fold. So this is Madison Reedy talking about the 100th episode, looking back across it, of Markets with Madison on the Fold. Kia ora, Madison. Welcome to The Fold.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited for this.
Oh, and congratulations, 100 episodes. That's wild.
Yeah, it is wild, actually. But then I feel like it's been more than 100. It feels like it's been 1,000.
Yeah, I can see that. It's a grind. But could you just rewind to the very start? Like, how did you get interested in business and then ultimately in markets in particular?
If we go right back to the beginning, when I was a kid, I was not at all interested in it. I remember when the market figures used to come up on whatever morning breakfast show my dad would watch while he was ironing his shirt heading to work. And I'll just stare at it. It was like, it hadn't made no sense to me. It was a whole different world, right? And then as I got older and just started to learn more about it, naturally by more people conversing about it around you, and also my family was in business, so just general conversations as I was growing up, you start to realize this is actually so interesting. But it's that access to that world that I feel is so limited. I think it's changing now, and definitely an obligation that I feel as well. But initially, I was very confused by it all, had no idea what any of it meant, how exciting it could be. And then when I actually got into journalism, I remember my dad saying to me once, "Oh, you should be a business journalist." I rolled my eyes, as you do to your parents back then, and said, "No way, that's not interesting at all." And then actually when I became a journalist, I've only ever been a business journalist.
It's interesting that you say that, right? Because, I if I could do it over again, I would love to have just gone down that path and not the sort of more peripatetic generalist
it's
one that
too
I've
late
taken.
Dark.
I know. Well, I'd like to dally in it occasionally. But the thing that you said at the start about it looking impenetrable, I think, mm-hmm. is just this sort of known and seemingly permanent problem with business and markets coverage, is that it uses this level of jargon and kind of like a particular formal style, which makes it hard to access. And I think part of what you've done in a way is break some of those paradigms that make it a little bit more accessible. It's still very
Thank
much
you.
For people who are into it, but it doesn't have some of the stylistic kind of, this is, hey, just so you know, this is going to be boring kind of stuff that just sort of sits in the air around how markets are covered. It's not there.
And honestly, that's easy, because the stuff is so interesting. And I think once you get rid of the acronyms like EBITDAF, ROE, and stop talking about return on equity, it's just profits or, top line, bottom line. It's just revenue and profit. It is actually so simple. And all businesses are, no matter what they do, is people that are so passionate about providing one service or providing one product or an array of them. And once you get down to that layer and meet those people and start learning from them and see their excitement and the opportunities ahead of them, discuss the risks with them, it just paints the most incredible story all of the time.
The thing about markets and about business journalism is that it has a reputation as being sort of dominated by sort of older white guys who like to surround themselves with their own demography and unnecessarily welcoming to people who are coming in who maybe don't have their experience or knowledge but are curious to find out. When you started to move into that world, when you decided, yeah, I am going to be a business journalist and start to get a bit deeper down these paths, how did you find the sector in a broad way in terms of how welcoming or otherwise it was to you?
I am very happy to report back that I have always been welcomed with open arms, right back to when I was a junior business journalist and would wear pink with braces in my early 20s. Like, I still had executives then welcoming me in and being willing to talk about their businesses because, as I say, they're typically so excited about them. Obviously, there are stories of businesses that are not good and they're less welcoming then, but that's obviously just because they don't want to talk about what's going on. But I have always been so welcomed. I think as long as you go in with this curiosity, willingness to learn, no agenda, you go in just wanting to understand, you will always be welcomed in. And I've been so lucky and I'm so happy by that. And I think that's a real testament to New Zealand's business sector, whether that's public or private as well. You know, everyone wants to help each other out. It's cool.
So before you started at the Herald, your first jobs in media were at RNZ and News Hub. You were in the business teams, which are, they're part of their mix, but they're not super prominent in the mix. What did you sort of learn in those organisations?
Well, that's where I learned most about business. And if I can give a shout out to Radio New Zealand's business editor, Giles Beckford, he taught me pretty much everything I've learned about listed companies and the way that markets operate. My understanding of economics going in was limited. You know, I have absolutely no formal training on business and markets and economics. It's all just been self-learning. And so I've just been a sponge to people like that. So I've been very lucky to learn off people that have a massive depth of knowledge. And I also think I haven't been scared to ask and I haven't been fearful to pick up the phone and ask a CEO a question or talk to an economist or buy them a coffee and just been willing to pick their brains. And I genuinely do think that is the best way to learn is off other people. As long as you're open-minded to it, all of that information is there to access.
After that sort of the period at those organisations, you know, we actually met for the first time when you worked on a podcast with us for Deloitte.
Yes.
And obviously, like, you know, that went on to, or not through that, but subsequent to that, you went sort of client side in a way at Jarden and a really big and interesting investment bank, which, you know, for a lot of people within journalism, Once you cross that bridge, that tends to be one way, right? Tell me what it was like to go from, you know, doing business journalism to working within a business on their sort of content and communication side.
It was like being a nerd in isolation in the news, where, especially when I was on TV at the time, and you're so obsessed with business and markets and you watch them daily, but there's kind of nobody else around you that's as obsessed and excited by them, so you feel quite odd. And then you enter this world and it's like meeting the mates you never knew that you could have, and you walk in there and there's literally hundreds of people that are obsessed with the same thing. It's like, I found my people. It was kind of like finding a religion in a way, right? So I absolutely loved the change, and it was something that I needed at the time. So I felt lucky to have had that opportunity. It was actually, you know, that job didn't exist in the industry. And it was something that just through discussions with the CEO of Jarden, the investment bank, and the head of research and others at the time, that we just decided, why don't we do this? And again, I was, you know, lucky. I think I've been so lucky in my career that I had people of that caliber trust me and say, we think you can do this, even though I definitely didn't believe that I could myself. But I think you have to try these things. And I got to a point in media where I felt like I wanted to be good at something else. And I was worried that I would go so deep down a path in media and just corner myself and see no way out. And I didn't want that to happen. So I saw an opportunity. We created it, really, took it and loved it. There were some challenges, obviously, within the role. Being in a financial firm, I've told you before, Dunk, but it's not the place where content really thrives. It's just not what they're best at. So it was a struggle. And it was a fight I was willing to have, and the one that I felt was important, because I saw all of the incredible insights and information and access that these firms had. And I thought there was a real opportunity to bring that to light to more investors and give more of it to their clients in more interesting and engaging ways. But yeah, making that shift was one that I loved. I really did love.
I mean, it's interesting you make that comment about what's naturally in you. Like, there's been this huge growth in communications teams and in sort of information forward products being created and distributed out of organizations of all scales over the past sort of 10 or 15 years, and which is, I think it's coincidence. I don't think it's causative in terms of the decline in journalism, but you know, we were talking before off air, and you know, when you hear about a podcast being started by an investment bank, you're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But if you thought about an investment bank being started by a podcast studio, that would seem completely crazy.
Should I say what I said to you?
Yeah, please do, because I think it matters. Like, what is natural to your organisation, right?
Yeah, well, and I said to you, gosh, if I ever start an investment bank then, like, Duncan's not going to be the first person I call and ask for a deal or financing, because he's obviously not going to give it to me, thinking it won't work. But yeah, totally. I mean, we know what makes content work, right? And these firms don't. They're incredible at other things. You know, whether it's a construction company or a financial firm, a KiwiSaver provider, they're so good at what they do. Content is just not in their wheelhouse. And it's something I think innate that you have in you. And like we were saying before, the energy it requires, the effort it requires, how relentless and obsessed you have to be with your audience and curiosity to make it work. Like, there's so much content out there, but I generally do think it's largely getting worse. I don't think it's getting better.
Agree.
And it's definitely not getting easier.
Well, there's just this kind of hailstorm of it, and the things that actually impact, that get more than like a sort of almost a Google crawler level handful of views, versus those which have real impact. The other thing is, like, you know, these institutions are typically governed by quite, you know, intense rules from like an FMA type perspective. So what can you really do? You're quite limited.
As I found out.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, not to kind of make this an ad for podcasting and just spending with media organizations, but there's a reason why we're good at reaching organizations and you might not be. The Fold is brought to you by oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa, with over 4,000 out-of-home advertising sites nationwide across both street furniture and retail centres. I'm super grateful to oMedia for enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
So, literally today, right, you know, as this is released, not as we record it, this is the 100th episode of Markets with Madison. This show you've created for the Herald and has really started to establish itself within that community, a space that wasn't particularly well served with the local context, but the audience has become much broader than that. So tell me about the genesis of the show.
So I came up with the idea for the show when I was still at Jarden. I think they know that. If they don't, they just found out, didn't they? So I, as we say, learned the restrictions. And look, those restrictions at a finance firm are there for a reason. You know, you have to keep people financially safe and put disclaimers on things. I'm not bagging that at all. But it just means that those places are not the place where content can win, because the environment is just not set up for it. So once I started to figure that out, I thought, look, I still think this content is really important. I know how intelligent and incredible and smart and interesting, you know, these executives and these analysts are, and the stories that they have to tell. So I still felt this obligation, but I realized that the format needed to change. So I kind of said to them, look, guys, I don't think this is working, but I'm going to go and create something myself. Which they were so excited for me. And you know, they still love the show and they message me about it all the time, sometimes on it, not always. But, yeah, I came up with the idea, and what's eventuated is obviously different to the idea. I actually heard this amazing Steve Jobs quote the other day, the sort of sickness that, you know, you don't let your idea eventuate into something else, which it really has. So it started as notes on my phone. About what was going to be a daily markets show. Thank God I did not stick to that because of the energy and amount of caffeine that that would require. So now it's as you know, 2 days a week, Monday and Friday. But the idea has stuck, which is the same. It is the aim to give investors a better understanding of the companies and trends that they invest in. And I think it really has done that. One thing that I've really actually leaned into, which I didn't see in the beginning, was the access it can provide, not only to insights, but to executives, and to take my audience inside these incredible, valuable companies to not only get to know the leaders better, but to get to know the strategy, what it's doing, what its sort of hopes and dreams and all of the risks it's assessing are. So that's the way it's changed. And yeah, I'm really pleased to say it is working.
In terms of where it sits in the Herald's product mix, it's something of an outlier in terms of, you know, most of the Herald is about written stories. Most of it, you know, the premium journalists like yourself or senior journalists are encouraged to stay behind the paywall. You know, they're encouraged to focus on a domestic audience. Do you want to just describe how you were able to kind of sell in to the Herald hierarchy something that kind of breaks a lot of those general rules about content over there?
I'm definitely breaking a lot of rules, and I am definitely the exception to the existing rules. When I started the show, I was adamant it had to be free. I thought if we as the Herald want to gain access to an investor audience, we have to make it accessible. You don't get to start a show and then not let people see it. So I was ruthless about that at the beginning. And as we were saying before, you know, I am ruthless about a lot of things. Look, I understand my face and name is on it. I have that relationship with my audience, and every single decision I make is for them. And I'm obsessed with offering that content up to them, and anything that doesn't work in their favour, I will not do. I make that very clear. Sometimes perhaps too clear, but I think you do have to be like that. And if you're not obsessed with your audience, it's not going to work.
So, and you're obsessed with your audience, you're also obsessed with YouTube, which has become the primary distribution vehicle, which is why it has this sort of international audience. Do you want to brag for a second? Just tell us a little bit about, you know, some the kind of scale of the audience, some of your hits, and just give a bit of a joined up sense of what it has become, and particularly with relationship to YouTube.
For the record, when I emailed you about this dunk yesterday, I said, I don't want to brag.
But yeah, but unfortunately, I'm forcing you to.
Since you're asking, and I do appreciate the opportunity, it has blown me away. Truly, like I knew that there was a gap there in the market for an investor audience to talk about more listed companies, you know, both in the States and in Europe and in New Zealand and Australia. And I'm so thrilled that it's working and that people are jumping on the content and love it. The views are insane. So 100 episodes in total just on the Herald and YouTube. So that doesn't include Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, or, you know, things being reshared on Twitter. 1.4 million views. And views is hard to get. Like, it's not just, you know, people clicking on something and having a quick read of it. Like, views are, like, you appreciate them, you know. Someone actually watched my show.
Yeah, you don't get a YouTube view just for 3 seconds. They have to actually make it through, right?
Yeah, and the thing with YouTube as well, as you know, is you see all of the analytics. So I know exactly how long somebody's watching for. I can see where they dropped off. I can see the most replayed or most watched hits. I can see how it was offered up to them. So it was either recommended by YouTube, or it came up on YouTube Home, or they came from other means like Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn or something like that. So YouTube, for the insights it offers you, are amazing. And as I was saying to you before as well, I did actually, when I started the show, I set it up and formatted it for a YouTube audience. While I'm surprised by the views, it was no surprise to me that my YouTube audience and an increasingly international audience quite quickly superseded that of the Herald.
In terms of the big interviews that you've had. I just want to talk about a few of those kind of highlights of those first 100 episodes. The most recent, the reason I reached out to you was or the most recent kind of conflagration in a way, was an interview with Adrian Orr, the governor of the Reserve Bank, which, I mean, it gathered a huge response. You know, like many viewers, thought he didn't come across particularly well on it, even though, you know, what the questions you were asking were the questions we all have been wanting him to be asked. Do you want to just tell me about that encounter and about that sort of specific moment when he sort of feels like he's affronted at the idea that you would put to him what seems like a very kind of obvious question about our recent sort of economic performance as a nation there in his or the Reserve Bank's relationship to it?
Look, I think my questions were A, not nice to be asked, and B, offered him an opportunity to defend the system and his role in it. So I think he saw that being offered up to him and he took it. So look, good on him. You know, like they say, when every hedge fund person goes on CNBC, they're pushing their book, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I went into it with the aim to better understand, not argue. And I do think it was unfortunate that the latter occurred. Like, I genuinely didn't want that. I don't think that ever benefits any audience. But look, you know, all I can do is ask the questions and do the research and actually shout out to my audience, because going into that, you know, I asked them what they wanted to ask. And that, I think, is really testament to the relationship that I have with them. And they made it very clear to me that, Maddie, we don't want to know about rates. We don't care about what's really happening to mortgage rates. Of course, the economy cares and it does matter. But the overwhelming response was about inflation and money printing and the erosion of purchasing power. So look, with their knowledge, you know, and mine added together, I think that's what made it quite powerful.
Let's have a quick listen down to that. There's a particular kind of flashpoint in it where, you know, you're basically asking him, like, there's a general economic theory here that if you put a bunch of money into an economy, something will happen. We've seen that happen, you know, can reflect on it kind of thing. And I think just hearing his response to that, I don't know. It always feels instructive when you know, and that's the power of video, the power of audio, right? So we'll just listen down now.
We print a number on a piece of plastic, which is an IOU that people trust because of what's behind it.
What happens if people stop believing in the money that you print?
Then you have situations like Argentina.
This is a trust-based system. Yeah. And we know that money, the whole idea of it, the concept of it, is centred around trust and credibility. The trust that people's purchasing power will not be eroded.
That's right.
But our purchasing power has gone backwards.
Yeah.
Since 2018, I believe you got here in March 2018, according to your inflation calculator, our purchasing power has gone backwards by 19.4%.
Yeah, which is terrible.
It is terrible. So what is ensuring that the New Zealand dollar still has that store of value that you say is important if the Reserve Bank isn't doing it right now?
So it's interesting you asked a couple of things. First of all, that is bad. So inflation is evil.
But was inflation not the expansion of money supply by the Reserve Bank through the LSAT bond buying program, through low interest rates?
How did you feel walking out of the room that day?
I was shaken, absolutely. I actually went and had a coffee with my dad afterwards and I was like shaking and saying to him that it was, you know, I didn't actually know how it had gone. And I didn't watch the interview until the very end of that day because I just needed some breathing space from between doing it and then watching it. And I genuinely did not think it was good. I walked out of that room thinking that, you know, I did not think I did a good job. I don't think I defended my point well enough. And then when I watched it and I thought, oh, okay, it's actually okay. Because when I was in there, I was so internally struggling with, am I defending my points hard enough? He's saying that inflation is evil, but is inflation not actually also money printing? Does that make the Reserve Bank evil? And he's, you know, saying that, you know, all these things about money printing, and he was kind of proving my points, but then defending them. I look at it now and I go, cool, it worked and it paid off, and my audience loved it, which is all that matters, the only measure that matters to me. I will add what I said at the end of that show, though, is that when I also walked out of there, I thought, you know, wow, how lucky am I to not only be invited in, to be able to sit there and roll a camera and ask questions for, I mean, they gave me a time frame, but I ran 15 minutes over it, you know, and no one stopped me. He didn't get up and walk out. He answered the questions. Like, kudos to the guy for that, you know, and kudos to the Reserve Bank team for being so open to it. And they've spoken to me afterwards. And, you know, I do value that relationship and want to continue it. So I think there's that real balance you have to strike between wanting to ask the right questions and wanting to get, information and understanding out of somebody, enlightening, you know, and have an enlightening discussion. So I think we achieved that, which is cool. And look, I really do hope we can do it again.
So a different interview, but just as big a get, kind of bigger in a way, was with Cathy Wood, who, you know, Alice's might not necessarily know who she is, but within the world of investing, particularly technology investing, she has got like an extraordinary reputation. She's a cult figure, one of the most known, discussed, sometimes divisive people in that world. And that has become, I mean, that is a huge chunk of your views are associated with that one interview, which is at a very specific topic. Do you want to tell me how you got that get and, you know, about why you chose that quite specific topic to go into with her?
I mean, that is the topic du jour of the moment. And it actually, the Friday that we released that weekend was when Bitcoin hit a record price. So there were all elements that sort of caused that video to get, I think I checked last night, it was close to 500,000 views on YouTube, which is just insane. Like, I can't even fathom that many people in a football field. It's absolutely wild to me. I've actually spoken to Cathy Wood about four times and always loved my chats with her. I think it was really the topic that made that one fly. And I'd asked to interview her about sort of four times at the beginning of this year after the Bitcoin ETF launches. Mm. If anyone doesn't know, Cathy Wood and her firm ARK Invest are behind the ARK 21 Shares Bitcoin ETF. It's about the third most popular in terms of assets under management and flow into it. So it's they've all taken off, right? They've been incredibly successful. But she's had a long, long running view on Bitcoin and its price hitting, you know, her forecast is $1 million by the year 2030. But no one had spoken to her after the ETF success about how her price target had changed and what her perhaps updated figure and timeline for that was. So I was really keen just to chat with her. So I reached out through the Nikko Asset Management team here and have a great relationship with them. And they just put me in touch with Cathy again and her team, and she was keen to do it. It was just about making a time. And when we finally had that time, it actually ended up being perfect given all of the interest in Bitcoin at the time. So it was a lot of luck and also a little bit of hard work.
In terms of that topic selection, you know, the Bitcoin halving and this is that's esoteric for a lot of, like, there'll be a lot of investors who are like, crypto's a no-go zone, or even, you know, people who are interested in crypto but find Bitcoin, that some of the crypto is very, very weird as an area. But I think, you know, one of the things that you've done with the show is say, actually, because a lot of what we create in media around markets or businesses is a sort of a broad overview that anyone who's really interested already knows that stuff. So it's sort of like there's a little bit of a who's this for with it, whereas you've got a real specificity, increasingly so, with the show. What's sort of driving that? And, you know, you talked off air about yourself as the EP, like, you know, which is that's a very New Zealand situation. Just talk through your kind of story selection kind of process.
I make all the calls. So I'm completely agnostic to assets. If money's flowing to something, I follow it. So it's not about whether I like Bitcoin or like private equity or care about the Magnificent Seven. If money's going to it, like, I've got to chase it, because if that's where people are putting their funds, I want them to better understand it, right? So Bitcoin is something that I was probably late to in terms of understanding it, but early compared to the rest of mainstream media, I think. So I started looking into it late last year. And, you know, I have a lot of people around me. My network is amazing. And they were also pushing me to look into it, saying, you know, you need to increase your understanding of this because it's going to come up in conversation more. And my biggest fear is going into any conversation and not knowing something. So I always have this innate drive to want to learn and be on the front foot to understand something, that when that conversation does inevitably come up, that I know what I'm talking about, right? So I started looking into it. And this was in sort of probably September last year, and this is when, you know, there was all this talk about the ETFs launching. It's probably around the same time that BlackRock's Larry Fink started deciding that he was getting into it as well. So there'd been that shift from institutional firms and investment firms like BlackRock as well, which is a huge statement. So I thought, well, hell, I'm actually late at this point. But then when I put out one of my first Bitcoin episodes, it absolutely flew. And I think it was a lot of investors here that follow Bitcoin or are invested in it didn't expect that the mainstream media would do the work. So pleased that I did, and I think it's paid off. And I think it also really pays to be early to things. You'd rather be early than late. And look, I was nervous when I put out that first episode because I don't want to be seen to be pumping anything, but I want to give people more context on any asset.
That's a really good kind of balanced theory of why and that actually serves as a kind of good way of explaining journalistic purpose. We're not actually, when you cover something, you're not endorsing it, you're just saying this is happening. One final interview, and then the one that I think for you was a kind of a bit of a breakthrough in some respects was Rocket Lab. Tell me about how that came about and how that sort of popped you into a different, you know, whether it's internationally or with YouTube, like what was the function of that for you?
I loved creating that episode. That was so much fun. I have been covering Rocket Lab and speaking with Peter Beck since about the beginning of my career. So I've built up a relationship with him and his team. Might I add, is still some of the same team that, you know, back when I was a junior reporter. So I had an awesome relationship with them. That was actually the second time I'd had Peter on the show. But what it really proved to me was the insane improvements we've made in production. So when I first interviewed Peter for the show, and he actually threw some shade at Elon Musk, so it was a really good interview. He said something like, when we put rockets on the launch pad, we want them to work. And that was after SpaceX had blown one up. So that was a great chat. But we did it via Zoom. He was in Long Beach at the time. The connection wasn't great. We didn't have the kind of production nous in the show that used all of the cool vision of rockets launching and didn't give investors context leading into that conversation, which is the improvements we made leading into the second interview with Peter. So I thought, look, even though I've spoken to him, there obviously have been major changes in the space industry, even within those few months, because it's such a fast-paced and epic industry to look into. And I knew that Rocket Lab was building this massive rocket. So I thought, let's see it. And when he's home, let's go out to the Mount Wellington Rocket Lab site. Can Peter show us on a tour? Let's make it visually epic. And let's actually sit down and get a better understanding of the space economy and industry as a whole, where it's heading, the opportunities, and where Rocket Lab sees itself in it in the future. And, you know, going up against Elon Musk is always a great topic of conversation as well. So when we did that and the response to that episode was, it's got tens of thousands of views on YouTube and, you know, has had podcast downloads and it went really well on the Herald as well. That to me just proved what's possible, not only when the production just really, really hits, but also when you have a much deeper, well-rounded conversation. That interview with Peter Beck, while the idea of it was about the space economy, my very first question to him was like, why are you selling stock? So it went from like the highest of broad macroeconomic levels right down to you sold some of your shares recently. And I think investors really appreciated the breadth and depth of that. And what it also showed to me is the importance of an idea. So it wasn't just going inside Rocket Lab, here's a chat with Peter Beck, which is still cool. By no means am I bagging that. But the idea about it was the space economy. And it opened people's eyes and sort of imagination to everything that Rocket Lab's trying to do and the whole purpose behind this business. And now I just really aim for that in every single episode. It's not about who I have on. It's not about what company. Of course, that helps. And visual aspect is massive as well. But if every episode is focused around a central idea, whether it's the Bitcoin price target changing, whether it is the space economy, I've found that to really fly. So that episode was, while I loved it for many reasons, I love it because it showed me that.
It's really impressive, and you know, just overall the kind of going and building something from scratch and using the kind of different communication tools we have nowadays, and taking an institution like the Herald and kind of collaboratively learning and teaching a different way of getting information out. It's super impressive, and yeah, looking forward to seeing the next 100. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Madison.
Thanks so much for having me, Duncan. Again, you've always been such an amazing supporter of me through my career, so I really appreciate it.
Oh no, just so, it's so good to see you soar, honestly.
That was The Fold, brought to you by our partners at oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Huge thanks to oMedia for sponsoring this episode of The Fold and enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-Off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-Off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spin-Off Podcast Network.